From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's not too much to say that Doc Watson is one of the world's greatest flat-picking guitarists. On today's Fresh Air, he joins us for a live concert of duets with guitarist Jack Lawrence. Also today, conductor John McGlynn talks about his latest contribution to American music, his new recording of Showboat, featuring the original orchestrations, and restoring songs that were cut from the original 1927 production. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two albums from country singer Buck Owens, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines Jesse Jackson's recent suggestion that the term black be replaced by the term African American. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Guitarist and singer Doc Watson visited Fresh Air for an interview last spring. We hoped that someday he'd come back to do a live concert, and I'm delighted to say today's the day. Doc Watson is considered the finest flat picker in the country. He was one of the performers who inspired the folk revival of the 60s, and he's remained at the forefront of traditional music. In fact, he's one of the most revered figures in folk music today. Watson grew up in Deep Gap, North Carolina, where he continues to live. He's performing duets for us today with guitarist Jack Lawrence, who is also featured on Doc Watson's latest album, Portrait. I want to welcome both of you to Fresh Air, and Doc Watson, can I ask you to introduce the first song?
Thank you, Terry. I think we'll do one that my son Merle and I learned from John Hurt. A good old tune called Make Me Down a Pallet on Your Floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. I'm going up the country through that sleet and snow. Going up the country through that sleet and snow. Yes, I'm going up the country through that sleet and snow. Ain't no telling just how far I'll go. Getting my breakfast here and my dinner in Tennessee. Get breakfast here and dinner in Tennessee. Gonna get my breakfast here, my dinner in Tennessee. Told you I was coming, so you better look for me. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. What do you think about it, Jack? I like that notion right there. Well, you know that I can't lay down on your bed. Now, honey, I can't lay down on your bed. No, baby, can't lay down across that pretty bed. Cause my good woman, she might kill me dead. And don't you let my good gal catch you here. Hey, don't you let my good gal catch you here. If you do, she may shoot you. She might cut and stab you too. Ain't no telling what that gal might do. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down? Make it soft and low. Then maybe my good gal, she won't know. The way I've been sleeping, my back and shoulders tired. The way I've been sleeping, my back and shoulders tired. Yeah, the way I've been sleeping, my back and shoulders tired. I think I'll turn and try sleeping on my side. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. Let's play some country counterpoint, son. Mm-hmm. down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, make it over, close behind that door. Make it where your good man will never go.
All right.
Guitar straps will squeak, Jack.
That's yes, the way, they will.
That's the way it works. I'd like to do a little tune here that I used to hear Brownie and Sonny do. Excuse me. It's a blues that everybody's had at one time or another. It's called Stranger Blues. Two, three, four. Well, I'm a stranger here. I just blowed in your town. Yes, I'm a stranger here. I just blowed in your town. And just because I'm a stranger, you don't have to dog me around. Well, sometimes I wonder why some people treat a stranger so. Sometimes I wonder why some people treat a stranger so. Can't find a place to stay, I just go from door to door. Well, I'm a stranger here, I just blowed in your town. Yes, I'm a stranger here, I just blowed in your town. And just because I'm a stranger, you don't have to dog me around. Get them blues, Mo. Send up my railroad fare. Yeah, I'll ride home to Daddy to send up my railroad fare. And boys, if he can't send it, well, I don't mind walking there. Well, I'm a stranger here. I just blowed in your town. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm a stranger here. I just blowed in your town. And just because I'm a stranger, you don't have to dog me around. Well, now I'm going back home. Have to wear out 99 pair of shoes. Well, yes, now I am. I'm going back home. Have to wear out 99 pair of shoes. And when I get back down to Dixie, I won't have the stranger blues. Well, I'm a stranger here. I just blowed in your town. Listen to that walking. Yes, I'm a stranger here. I just blowed in your town. And just because I'm a stranger, you don't have to dog me around.
When the late Jimmy Rogers did his last sessions in the early 30s, he did some music that sat right in the edge of the big band music of that day. Well, here's a pretty little tune old Jim recorded called Blue Eyed Jane. The sweetest girl in the world lives in my hometown. We fell in love like turtle doves while the moon was shining down. I asked her then, I asked her when the wedding bells would ring. And she said, oh dear, it seems so strange for this to happen here. She is my sugar pal. Oh, to me she is the sweetest gal. I love her so, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, she meets me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane. Play it pretty, Jack. Listen here, Janie dear, I've come to say farewell. Sweetheart, you know I love you so much more than there's words to tell. But I must go away today, honey, won't you come with me? 'Cause I'm gonna be blue, missing you, longing every day for you, my blue-eyed Jane. Hold of me, you are the sweetest thing. I love you so, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, please meet me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, then I'll come home to you, my blue-eyed Jane.
We're featuring a live concert on Fresh Air, and performing is Doc Watson on guitar and vocals, also a little harmonica there. Also joining us is Jack Lawrence on guitar, and they've recorded together on Doc Watson's last album, Portrait. And before we continue the concert, okay if I ask you both a couple of questions about your playing?
We'll either shake our heads or something.
Doc, you really set the standard of flat picking guitar. How did you start doing that yourself?
Well, I've loved the guitar ever since I first heard one and found out what it really was. And then I'm going to tell you something that will surprise a lot of the folks. I played a bunch with a rockabilly group in the 50s and got in one heck of a good bunch of technical practice on the guitar. I played an electric guitar there for a while, but when the folk revival came along, I jumped back on the old flat top and went to work on all them fiddle tunes that I know the folks that were longing for traditional music would like to hear. And I reckon that the 50s practice done me a lot of good, though.
Did you? Did someone teach you to flat pick, or did you just?
No, I learned by ear. That's the reason my chords look kind of funny to you folks that are accustomed to seeing these fellas play according to the book, I think.
Oh, I see. So you really did learn it your own way.
Yes, I did. I learned by ear.
Now, how did you both get together, Jack? How did you start playing with Doc Watson?
Well, I was hired in the fall of 83 by a fellow named Merle Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Doc's son, of course. He hired me on because he getting a little tired of the road life, and so in the fall of 83 they called me, and they haven't been able to get rid of me since.
Had you listened to all of Doc Watson's records before you started playing together?
Well, most of them. I started playing in 63 or so, and along with Doc, people like Glenn Campbell Glenn was an influence, and several others.
Do you work out the songs before you play them? How do you go about figuring
sometimes
what an arrangement will be?
Uh-huh.
Occasionally we'll work them out. Mostly it's arrangements while you wait.
Doc, I should mention that the last time you were on our show last spring, you said that you were thinking of retiring at the end of the year. What's the story with that?
Well, evidently, I decided not to retire at the end of last March. I will retire in the near future, but I'll not expound any farther on the matter.
Are you enjoying being on the road? Or?
I enjoy the music, and I like working with old brother Jack here. He's a pretty good feller, you know, but the road, that's for the birds or something other.
Would music be a lot better if the audiences all came to you instead of you having to travel around the country?
I don't know about that. If I could travel out to a local good big spot where that'd work fine. That'd be just fine.
Yeah. Well, I'll see if we can arrange that. Well, what I'd like to do is take a short break and then continue the concert. And performing live for us today is Doc Watson and Jack Lawrence. And we'll be back with more of the concert after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Doc Watson and Jack Lawrence joining us for a live concert today, and why don't we get started with another song?
Here's a little tune about an old boy that excuse me, that decided he's going to leave home and learn to travel. And he found a pretty little girl and got married and got two for the price of one. And I'll let the song tell you the rest of the tale. It's called Give Me Back My 15 Cents. Tennessee, and I thought I'd learn to travel, but then I met with a pretty little gal, and soon we played the devil. I loved that gal, and she loved me, and I thought we'd live together, but then we tied that fatal knot, and now I'm gone forever. Give me back my 15 cents, give me back my money, give me back my 15 cents, and I'll go home to Mammy. Yeah, let me hear your opinion. Twas 15 cents to the preacher man and a dollar for the paper. Then dear old mother-in-law moved in, and lordy, what a caper. I fiddled a tune for her one day, and she called me a joker. Then that old sow got mad at me and hit me with the poker. Give me back my 15 cents, give me back my money, give me back my 15 cents, and I'll go home to Mammy. Town and I worked on the farm, but there was no way to suit them. They're both so dad burned mean to me, somebody ought to shoot them. I'm tired of looking at my mother-in-law. I'd like to see my granny. Gonna leave the state of Arkansas and go back home to Mammy. Give me back my 15 cents, give me back my money, give me back my 15 cents, and I'll go home to Mammy.
Jack, I think a good old train song might be in order right here. Son, I remember that song over there that Brother Jimmy Jett wrote. And I'm going to plug an album right here. I ain't supposed to do this, but it's on an album I did for Sugar Hill called Riding the Midnight Train, a bluegrass album, my first endeavor on pure bluegrass. Greenville Trussell is a song for the train buffs that love the good old steam engine sounds and all that good. I remember when I went to school at Raleigh, there was a train went by every 20 minutes on an average. And this song makes me think of those days. I remember as a boy how in wonderment and joy I'd watch the trains as they'd go by, and the whistle's lonesome sound you could hear for miles around as they rolled across that Greenville Trussell High. But the whistles don't sound like they used to. Lately, not many trains go by. Hard times across this land mean no work for a railroad man, and the Greenville Trussell now don't seem so high. Thank you, son. On the river bank I'd stand with my cane pole in my hand and watch the freight trains up against the sky. That black smoke trailing back as they moved along the track that runs across that Greenville Trussell High. But the whistles don't sound like they used to. Lately, not many trains go by. Hard times across this land mean no work for a railroad man, and the Greenville Trussell now don't seem so high. When the lonesome whistles whined, I'd get rambling on my mind. Lord, I wish they still sounded that way. As I turned to head for home, Lord, she'd rumble low and long toward the sunset at the close of day. But the whistles don't sound like they used to. Lately, not many trains go by. Hard times across this land mean no work for a railroad man, and the Greenville Trussell now don't seem so high. No, the Greenville Trussell now don't seem so high.
Well, sir.
Jack, I remember a while back you wrote a pretty little song, and I'm going to let you introduce this.
All right. Well, I would rather say made up than wrote. This is a tune I made up, and it's, I suppose inspired partly by the part of the country where Doc's from. It for sure the title is inspired by that. It's called 10 Miles to Deep Gap, and I made it up. Thank you.
We're featuring a live concert today with Doc Watson and Jack Lawrence, and it looks like we'll have time for one more song.
Jack, while we're at it there, that instrumental sounded pretty good. Let's do him a little bit of something that ain't quite country here to kind of wind it down with. Something called Bye Bye Blues. When we play anything, it's country, though.
Live concert on today's Fresh Air with guitarist and singer Doc Watson and guitarist Jack Lawrence. And I want to thank you both so much for just a wonderful concert. Thank you so much for being with us today. If you'd like to hear them on record, Doc Watson's latest album is called Portrait, and it also features Jack Lawrence. It's on Sugar Hill Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And next time, our guest will be investigative reporter Mark Dowie. In his reporting for Mother Jones magazine, Dowie explains the dangers of the Fort Pinto's exploding gas tank and uncovered the health hazards of the contraceptive device, the Dalkon Shield. His new book looks into the world of organ transplants. I hope you can join us.
All right.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Virtually every fan of musicals is familiar with Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein's Showboat, but almost no one had heard all the music written for it until now. Conductor John McGlynn has recorded the music from Showboat, complete with songs cut before its Broadway premiere and songs written for the movie versions. Coming up, John McGlynn talks about restoring one of America's greatest musicals. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a pair of albums from country star Buck Owens, his new album, and a reissue of Owens' 1963 Carnegie Hall performance. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the politics behind what different racial and ethnic groups choose to call themselves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The judge in the Iran-Contra case today dismissed the central conspiracy charges against former White House aide Oliver North. Lawyers for the Reagan administration then moved quickly to quash North's subpoenas for President Reagan and President-elect Bush. More from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Peering down from the bench this morning, Judge Gerhard Gesell said, "This court is totally powerless to force this case to proceed." And with that, he threw out the major conspiracy and theft charges against North, leaving 12 counts and a potential jail term still pending against the former White House aide. Within hours, the Reagan administration asked the judge to throw out the subpoenas issued for President Reagan and President-elect Bush. The administration's brief, filed with the court, noted publicly for the first time that both Mr. Reagan and Mr. Bush had offered last September to answer written questions from North, an offer North apparently spurned in favor of broad subpoenas. Lawyers for the president and president-elect argued in papers filed today, however, that the historical and legal precedent would not allow such subpoenas to stand. No sitting or former president has ever been forced to testify as a witness at a trial. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
An American rancher with past links to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels has been arrested in Costa Rica on suspicion of arms and drug trafficking. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
John Hull has been living in Costa Rica for 20 years. He gained notoriety during the Iran-Contra affair when he admitted he allowed Contras to train and camp on his ranch in northern Costa Rica. Hull also admitted that he was receiving $10,000 a month from the National Security Council for his assistance to the Contras. At the time, Hull was working with Rob Owen, who told the Iran-Contra committee that he, Owen, was a courier for former presidential aide Oliver North. Hull has also been accused of helping to smuggle arms to the Contras and cocaine to the United States. Hull denies those charges. Costa Rican authorities are holding Hull on charges of drug trafficking and espionage. Costa Rican officials say the investigation centers on the use of his airstrip by suspicious aircraft. Hull faces charges leading to 6 years in prison or the loss of his Costa Rican citizenship. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The U.S. today welcomed Libya's return of the body of a U.S. flyer shot down in a 1986 American bombing raid of Tripoli. The body, believed to be that of Captain Paul Lawrence, arrived in Italy under Vatican protection today and was turned over to Italian authorities and placed in a morgue. U.S. authorities will not try to make a positive identification of the body. The Reagan administration, meanwhile, brushed aside Libya's claim that U.S. warplanes buzzed a Libyan commercial airliner this week. A Defense Department spokesman said the charge was investigated, but no justification for the claim was found. A prosecutor in West Germany said today he has opened a criminal investigation into the Imhausen Chemical Company. The U.S. says the firm helped build a chemical weapons plant in Libya. A German government investigation cleared the company of any wrongdoing just last week. But the chief prosecutor in Offenburg said he was opening the probe after reading a report in the Stern News magazine. A spokesman for the prosecution said the possible charge being investigated is a violation of the export control law. A TASS news agency report says Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze arrived today in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The previously unannounced visit comes about a month before Moscow is due to complete its troop withdrawal from the country under a UN-sponsored agreement. TASS did not reveal the purpose of Shevardnadze's visit. In Israel's occupied territories today, a 15-year-old Palestinian youth died one day after being shot in the head by Israeli soldiers in a refugee camp in the occupied Gaza Strip. In Jerusalem, assailants believed to be Jewish militants smashed a monument to Arab soldiers in East Jerusalem. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 4 points to close the week at 2226.07. Advances led declines. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1960s, Bakersfield, California was the center of country music and produced a sound that was heavy on electric guitar and at least partially influenced by Western swing. Some people started referring to the town as Buckersfield after one of its most influential musicians, Buck Owens. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Owens' new album, his first in over 8 years. From it, here's a little of Under Your Spell Again.
It's easy to figure out the country music comeback story of the past year, Buck Owens. Even as I say this name, I envision many of you grimacing and moaning, oh no, not that guy from Hee Haw. Yes, that Buck Owens. The one who used to grin too widely and trade corny jokes with Roy Clark on TV's most embarrassing country music show. Buck Owens hasn't been picking and grinning on Hee Haw since 1985, and he hasn't made an album since 1980, but right now he's the hottest name in country music. Why? Well, because one of his most sedulous students, Whippersnapper superstar Dwight Yoakam, recorded a duet with Owens on Yoakam's most recent album. That song, Streets of Bakersfield, was a big hit, and it's kicked off a new wave of Buck mania. He's still as corny as ever, though. His new album is called Hot Dog.
Long distance information, hit me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find a party, try to get in touch with me. She could not leave a number, but I know a place to call. Cause my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall.
That's Buck Owens doing Chuck Berry's Memphis. Hot Dog is better than any fan might have hoped because it connects the two seemingly disparate parts of Owens' career. On the one hand, Owens is one of the purest and most original of all country singers. When he first emerged in the late 50s, he wasn't some Nashville smoothie. He was recording in Bakersfield, California, where country music was relatively untouched by the glitz and slickness of Nashville, and Owens was one of the architects of the so-called Bakersfield sound. On the other hand, Buck Owens has always liked music with a strong beat and prominent rhythm, which meant that unlike many of his colleagues, he wasn't an enemy of rock and roll. In fact, more than most hardcore country artists, he embraced rock and recorded it. This new album includes that Chuck Berry song as well as a version of Eddie Cochran's Summertime Blues and the album's title song, a rockabilly rouser.
Well, my baby works in a hot dog stand. I'm making them hot dogs as fat as you can. Up steps, the cat yells, don't be slow. And get me two hot dogs ready to go. Hot dog! She's my baby. Hot dog! Drives me crazy. Hot dog! I don't mean maybe, well, you ought to see my baby at the hot dog stand. But in the cool of the evening when the sun goes down, all the chicks and the cats all are gathering around. They order hot dogs and red soda pop and head down the road to a hip cat hop. Hot dog! She's my baby. Hot dog! Drives me crazy. Hot dog! Don't mean maybe, well, you ought to see my baby at the hot dog stand.
The release of this new album, Hot Dog, coincides with the re-release of a long-out-of-print 1966 record called Buck Owens and the Buckaroos Live at Carnegie Hall. It's a fascinating document of Owens at his peak. By 1966, he'd had more than a dozen number one country hits, most of them included on this album. It's a record that also showcases the work of lead guitarist Don Rich, who, like Owens, was something of a country rebel. Don Rich played a Telecaster guitar, an instrument that yielded a ringing vibration that up till then had been primarily used by rock and rollers. Rich, who also sang harmony vocals with Owens, turned the Telecaster into a country instrument on songs like Love's Gonna Live Here.
Thank you. Oh, the sun's gonna shine in my life once more. Love's gonna live here again. Things are gonna be the way they were. Love's gonna live here again. Love's gonna live here. Love's gonna live here. Love's gonna live here again. No more loneliness, only happiness. Love's gonna live here again. You talk about a ham. That must be pure pork. I hear bells ringing.
Don Rich died in a motorcycle accident in 1974, and Buck Owens has said that after losing Rich, he lost his way as a musician. Owens started making mediocre records, hopped on the gravy train that was Hee Haw, and forgot about artistry. That is, until Dwight Yoakam rekindled his ambitions. These days, Owens is out touring again, and his music is as straightforward and powerful as ever.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Oh, jealous me and careless you, the odds were just too great. I couldn't take those lonely nights, you made me sit and wait.
I thought I'd seen the last of you when you walked out of sight. Instead, I see you in my dreams each night. Oh, the keys in the mailbox, come on in. I'm sitting here wishing, dear, I had you.
This is Fresh Air. Among this year's Grammy Award nominees is a recording of a now classic musical first produced in 1927, Showboat. It features music by Jerome Kern and lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II. John McGlynn, who directed and conducted the new recording, restored the songs that were cut before the 1927 Broadway opening. He also recorded an appendix that features songs written for later film and stage versions. McGlynn used the original orchestrations throughout. I asked John McGlynn why Showboat was such an important musical.
Everybody thinks of Oklahoma as the great watershed musical, the piece that, you know, finally integrated book and lyrics and music and dance and all of this. And in point of fact, many people, including myself, feel that Showboat in 1927 was the work that really did that. Showboat addressed issues which, for the time, were absolutely unheard of in the musical theater. You simply did not address issues of racial hatred, racial intermarriage, alcoholism, desertion by a husband. Things like that were just not part of what people went to the theater to see when they went to see a Florenz Ziegfeld musical.
How would you describe your overall vision in recording the complete Showboat?
It had always bothered me, both as an artist and as a fan, that Showboat had come to be known as the sort of light, frothy operetta. And I had always suspected that there were much deeper elements to it. And the more I studied the piece and the more I was able to get back to the original material and I saw what the full original scope of their conception was, I realized that this was really something extraordinarily dark and brooding and out of the ordinary. And in the recording, I felt it was absolutely imperative to restore all of the grit and the drama of the piece. There are several examples I can use, but the most important one and the one that's obviously caused the most discussion has been the restoration of the original language. I mean, the opening line of the show has always been a source of controversy. The curtain goes up on a levee in Mississippi. And it's in the 1880s, and the stage is full of these sweating black stevedores lugging cotton bales on their backs in the hot July sun. And the first words out of their mouth are, "Niggers all work on the Mississippi, niggers all work while the white men play." And Hammerstein wrote that word deliberately. It wasn't just the word that everybody used then and used thoughtlessly. He wanted to pick the word that would make this complacent society audience sit up and take notice and think about what life was like for these people 100 years ago in Mississippi.
Now, a lot of us know Old Man River opening with the lyrics, "Colored folk work on the Mississippi," or "Here we all work on the Mississippi." You restored it to the original, as you just described, but it caused quite a controversy within the cast that you were recording. A chorus of black singers who were supposed to sing it walked out. The baritone that was supposed to sing it walked out.
Yes.
Let's establish first why they wanted to walk out.
Well, what happened was it was very unfortunate that because of scheduling and rehearsals, I was not able to be present at the first chorus rehearsal. What we had planned to do was to use the chorus from the Glyndebourne production of Porgy and Bess, because I very much wanted to have a black chorus for the black music in Showboat. they got to the first rehearsal and they opened up their vocal scores, and of course the first word they see staring them in the face was nigger. Now, they did not know the show, they didn't know the context, they didn't know what the dramatic purpose of the word was, and they just went yipes, and they said, no way, sorry, we can't do this.
There's an irony here, I think, and that is that you ended up having to use a white chorus to sing Old Man River because the black chorus didn't want to sing the original text. And this is part of your attempt to get the most authentic recording possible.
Well, not only authentic, but I would like to think the most socially conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that happened like that, whether it be racial prejudice or genocide or anything, if we forget about it, it can happen again. And I think it's very dangerous to try to pretend that things like this never happened.
In your recording of Showboat, you reinstated a very beautiful song. And I think this is the perfect example of the dark and brooding atmosphere that you found when you found the complete manuscript for Showboat. The song I'm thinking of is Misery's Coming Round. And this is a song that foreshadows the tragic turn of events about to happen. It's very beautiful. Why was it deleted?
First of all, at the first performance in Washington, the first preview out of town, the show ran over 4 hours, which was simply not feasible within the format and economic market of a Broadway musical. So things had to go. And anything, I mean, the first casualties, of course, were anything that was not absolutely essential to the progression of the plot. And Misery, as beautiful as it is 6 minutes of atmosphere and mood painting rather than something specific happens that moves the plot along. That's the practical aspect. The other side of it is that Florenz Ziegfeld was terrified of it. And Ziegfeld absolutely was so afraid that it was going to kill the show stone cold, smack in the middle of the first act. And I can see him, you know, at rehearsal in my mind's eye, you know, sitting there chewing on a cigar and going, it's a downer, boys, it's a downer. But it's very interesting about Misery because its cutting is tragic because its themes are used as underscoring throughout the entire show. And you hear all these references to this dark, brooding theme without ever hearing its original statement and knowing what its context is.
Misery's coming around. Damn misery's coming around. I knows it's coming around. Don't know to who. Misery's coming around. Damn misery's coming around. We knows it's coming around. Don't know to who.
I think your recording is part of a trend in re-recording Broadway shows now of using opera singers to perform. And I was wondering if you think that the voices of opera singers are always appropriate.
I think most of the time they're very inappropriate.
Uh-huh.
And it really depends on the piece. Now, people have said, oh, well, you're recording Showboat and you're using opera singers. And to which my response is, no, actually, that thought never went through our heads. What we did is we recorded Showboat and cast the people who could sing it.
Do you think that your recording is an example of a trend in reevaluating the place of the musical theater in American musical life?
Boy, I sure hope so. I mean, so much of my career has been devoted to that, not just with Showboat, but with all the shows that I've worked on. When these shows were being written, nobody thought of them as great art. They were commodities. They were designed to make the authors and the producers money, and that's really all anybody thought about. Now, I'm convinced that in late at night in the dark recesses of their studies, the composers themselves did think of it as art. They knew they were creating beautiful music. But even so, they still treated it very much as a commodity. Orchestrations were not preserved. Manuscripts were not even preserved. If a song or a complete show wasn't a big hit, nobody felt it was important to preserve it in case it were going to be reevaluated by posterity 50 years later. What was the miracle that created people like Irving Berlin and Richard Rodgers and Jerome Kern and Cole Porter and Dietz and Schwartz, all at this one time, these incredible people? And artistry like that, and quite apart from the style has changed, but just that kind of artistry doesn't seem to exist en masse today. People just didn't think that it was all going to end. So I think now, you know, people are realizing that we've lost something incredibly precious and we better find it and reclaim it and preserve it as fast as we can.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure.
John McGlynn directed and conducted a new recording of Showboat on the EMI label. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a look ahead to All Things Considered. Robert, what's coming up on the program today?
Well, we'll be following the news in the Oliver North trial, the formal dropping of two of the key charges. We'll also be hearing a report from Barbara Mantell, our business correspondent, about steel import restrictions and the question of whether the Bush administration will continue to limit steel imports into the country. We'll be talking with Edson Army, who's an art historian from North Carolina, from the University of North Carolina, who believes that cars, American car designs, should be exhibited in our art museums because, indeed, they are developed almost as rolling sculpture.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A recent item in the news got our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg thinking about the names used to refer to various racial, ethnic, and religious groups, how these names have evolved, and what they reflect about our social attitudes.
Early on in Benjamin Disraeli's 1844 novel, Coningsby, the young hero meets up with the sage Sidonia, who holds forth dazzlingly on the political future of Europe. But Sidonia explains that he himself can't play any active role in political life because he's Jewish. Or, as he puts it, I am of that faith that the apostles professed before they followed your master. Over the course of the novel, Disraeli proceeds to describe Sidonia's race in half a dozen different ways. He's a Hebrew, an Israelite, a Levite, and a Mosaic Arab. The multiplicity of names and descriptions is a fair indication of the rapidly changing status of the Jews in 19th century England, which would soon allow the Jewish-born Disraeli to cut himself a new career as a politician and prime minister. Nowadays, Jews are simply Jews, their status in American culture being relatively stable as these things go. But the changing roles of other minorities are reflected in the volatility of their names. Over the past generation, for example, words like Hispanic and Latino have become part of the language as a way of acknowledging that Americans with origins in the Spanish-speaking cultures of Latin America and the Caribbean have certain interests and problems in common. And in a similar way, the acceptance of the word gay reflects a new realization that homosexuality is not simply a kind of sexual behavior, but also the basis for a social identity. Changing attitudes also explain the shifts from Indians to Native Americans, from Orientals to Asians, and from crippled to handicapped to disabled. But no group has a longer or more tortured linguistic history in this country than Americans of African descent. Over the last 200 years, they've gone from being called blacks to colored to Negroes and then back to blacks again. Now another change is in the offing. At a recent press conference in Chicago, Jesse Jackson and a number of other black leaders argued that the group should be referred to as African Americans. As Jackson put it, every other ethnic group in this country has a reference to some land base, some historical cultural base. African Americans have hit that level of cultural maturity. It's hard to say whether the use will catch on. On the one hand, I suspect that a lot of newspaper and magazine editors would be happy with a new term, if only because they would no longer have to wrestle with the question of whether to spell black with a capital B. As an ethnic group, blacks certainly deserve a capital letter like everyone else. The problem is that the word blacks is intrinsically opposed to whites, which has always been written with a lowercase w. But if you write the phrase blacks and whites with a capital B and a small w, you're asking for more letters than you want to answer. But in the long run, the decision won't be made either by editors or by influential leaders. The real question is whether blacks and whites both are ready to accept a profoundly different conception of race in America. As Jackson himself pointed out, all the older names, like colored, Negro, and black, refer to physical appearance, not place of origin. And if you want to get a sense of what the change would really entail, think how we normally talk about other ethnic groups. We don't usually say Kennedy was Irish-American, but simply Kennedy was Irish. We don't say that's a Greek-American neighborhood, but simply that's a Greek neighborhood. I have a Roman friend who's always mystified when he meets an American who says, oh, I'm Italian, and then turns out not to speak a word of the language. So if we run true to form with African-American, we should wind up dropping the American part and saying things like, there are no African head coaches in the NFL, or this is an African neighborhood. It seems only fair, and yet I'm not sure that Americans are ready to talk this way. It may take a long time to get past appearances.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. I'm about to take a vacation, and Sedge Thompson will host while I'm gone. On the next Fresh Air, Sedge speaks with poet, critic, and translator Robert Haas. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Austrian flugelhorn player Franz Kogelmann. Kevin says that Kogelmann's albums feature an interesting mix of European and American musicians and musical influences. And television critic David Bianculli takes a look at Pat Sajak's new late-night talk show. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.